Welcome to Blog Talk Radio in high fidelity.
From sunny San Diego, this is Pop Health Week on the Blog Talk Radio and Affiliate Networks, which is brought to you by Health Innovation Media. Welcome, everyone. I'm Greg Masters, the producer and co-host of the show. And in the virtual studio today, as always, is my trusted colleague, Fred Goldstein, principal co-host and co-founder here at Pop Health Week. Hello, Fred.
Hey, Greg. Great to be talking to you again, and glad your weather is so beautiful. Here in Jacksonville, Florida, the meteorologist said we are a 10 out of 10 today. So we're trying to compete with you beauty folks out in San Diego.
Okay.
Where we know it's always beautiful.
Well, I don't know about that. But, yeah, we have fans on both sides of the coast here, left and right. So for those of you not familiar with Fred, he is a consultant and president of Jacksonville, Florida-based Accountable Health, LLC. Fred is not known, and we'll hear more about that today, as the father of the annual wellness visit. More details shortly. Fred serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of Population Health Management and Population Health News, the Best Practices Review Panel, Institute for Medicaid Innovations at Medicaid Health Plans of America, and a recent appointee to the graduate faculty of the John D. Bauer School of Population Health, University of Mississippi Medical Center. Do follow Fred on Twitter via at FS Goldstein. My background includes thought leadership and strategy guidance for hospitals, health systems, and physician-led ventures. I publish and principally author ACOWatch.com and produce digital media content for the emerging value-based healthcare economy. Follow me on Twitter by @2HealthGuru. So on today's show, we're going to put Fred in the seat to review his sort of mix of top-line news in the population health accountable care and what may be seen as the convergence of these potentially siloed sectors under the banner of an emerging value-based healthcare economy. And why is this important? Because innovation in the legacy healthcare sector, whether on the delivery, financing, or fully integrated delivery and financing side, it's just not new, folks. Well, this may come as a surprise and even of the revelatory variety to many recent converts, particularly those associated with the digital health movement and its predecessor, mHealth Strain. I mean, does anyone remember mHealth? For those of us with an event horizon beyond the current 24/7, 365, fire hose obsessed news cycle, and presenting with a modicum of institutional memory and perhaps even wisdom, the innovation arsenal has deployed wave after wave of marginal and material adds to what I call the healthcare board, where all innovations go to die, as in your efforts will be assimilated by a legacy healthcare economy whose thirst will not be denied. So there's context, and I'm not going to throw cold water on those who are drawn to want to make a difference through tech or business models where tech really leverages the quality, quantity, and availability of services. By all means, continue on, but rock on and recognize that there's been a lot that's happened previously. So let's tap into a little bit of that. But first up, I have mentioned on prior broadcasts that Fred is the little-known father of the Medicare annual wellness visit. So today, let's take a bit of a dive into that story. So Fred, tell us about the genesis of this simple but incredibly impactful innovation.
Well, thanks so much, Greg. And it is an interesting story, at least for me it was, and a fascinating way to spend quite a bit of time on Capitol Hill and see how some of these things function. This all occurred while I was the president of U.S. Preventive Medicine, and for a while we had decided the company had actually run a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal discussing the importance of prevention in health reform back when President Obama was elected. And that had received a fair amount of attention, et cetera. So I was decided I would head to the Hill and just start working the Hill around prevention and see if we could get some things put into prevention. And so we had an advocacy group firm up there that we were using, and I began making the rounds, typically speaking with legislative aides within various offices who were involved with various healthcare committees, and talking to them about prevention and the importance of it, and telling them what our company did at U.S. Preventive Medicine, where we had built a employee wellness program built on the science of preventive medicine. It was based on the research, based on the clinical application of preventive medicine, and had gotten some pretty good pickup at that point. So as I started to make my rounds and meet with people, and every once in a while I get a chance to meet with an actual member of Congress, or perhaps say hi to a senator. But the majority of times with the staff, I did meet with the staff of the Senate Health Committee at one point, and I met with the staff on Ways and Means at another point. And ultimately, I got to know a woman named Janelle Krishnamoorthy. And Janelle Krishnamoorthy at that time was the lead legislative aide for Senator Tom Harkin. And Senator Harkin has been a prevention-focused, community-focused senator for years. And for about a decade, I think, at that point, he had been trying to put through legislation on prevention and to push some of that. So I met with Janelle, and at that point also, unfortunately, Senator Ted Kennedy, who had been the chair of the Senate Health Committee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, had brain cancer, and Senator Harkin had taken over as the chair of the committee. So after about four meetings over about 12 months with Janelle Krishnamoorthy, she called one day and told my advocacy firm, said, "Hey, get Fred up here. We've got a meeting with the senator." And I was really excited. This was going to be good. And so, as is typical with a senator, they're busier than you can imagine. And I get to the office, and the first thing they say is, "Hey, Fred, Senator Harkin has about 20 constituents sitting in his little boardroom over there who are supposed to meet with him. He's got you on his schedule, and he's got to run to the floor to do a vote. So you're going to do a walk and talk." And a walk and talk is where you get a chance to just head down the halls with the congressional member or the senator, and tell them what you're doing while they head off to their next thing. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly they came to me and said, "Fred, you've got 5 minutes with the senator. Get in there, but do not go over 5 minutes. He's got a vote. We're going to yank him out. And if you're not done, you're not done. It's too bad." So yeah. I head in there and sit with Senator Harkin. And the first thing he mentioned was that full page ad in the Wall Street Journal. He said, "I know you guys. I saw the ad." It was exciting. So timing was everything. And then he said, "Tell me what you do." And I proceeded to talk about U.S. Preventive Medicine and our program, and built on the science of preventive medicine, and how we were trying to identify risks and help people work through those risks. And he said, "That's incredible. Does anyone else?" He said, "Nobody does what you do." And I said, "Well, Senator, there are other companies in that space that do it." And he said, no, I've looked at them. They're no good. There's nobody does that," which was really fascinating. I turned to him, I said, "Yeah, Senator, you can feel free to say that. I'm not going to." And right. Then they're at the door. They're trying to get him out. And he turns to Janelle Krishnamoorthy and says, "How do we get that service that U.S. Preventive Medicine does covered?" And I said, "Senator, do you mind? I have an idea." And he said, "No, what do you got?" And I said, "Give me a CPT code."
There you go.
And he looked at me and said, "That's a good idea." And then he left.
Uh-huh.
And 3 weeks later, Janelle calls the firm in D.C. and says, "Tell Fred we've got some news he's going to like."
Mm.
And what that is that annual Medicare wellness visit, our program at U.S. Preventive Medicine, as you may recall, at that time was called the Prevention Plan. It's now the Preventive Plan, but it was the Prevention Plan. And the header for that section of the bill is an annual Medicare wellness visit to establish a personalized prevention plan. So they named the section after our program at UNS Preventive Medicine. And
how convenient.
But it was also, it was pretty amazing. So a couple of points out of this. One is it goes to show that if you can find champions, you don't have to have a boatload of lobbying dollars, as we see, that tend to flow into healthcare. And if you have a good idea and find the right person, you can get it through. And it really was the senator doing this. He had been trying to do something in this space for decades. What was also interesting was that the original uptake for that was terrible. Nobody understood it. What's an HRA? Don't make us do this. But ultimately, they realized, one, the payment was pretty good for it. You could do it every year. And it provided you with unique data that you didn't get through a history and physical. And now it's become something I think that, as we saw at the Florida Association of ACO meetings, you may recall, companies are bragging on how high a rate of annual Medicare wellness visits they get with their ACO members or their Medicare Advantage members, et cetera.
Right. Well, if you just think of how siloed our industry is, unless you're in an a fully integrated delivery system, and even those best-in-class players have room for improvement. But you come, 10,000 people a day qualify for Medicare? How many of those people defer medical care to knowing that, I'm being on Medicare here, next year, so I'm just going to hang in there? So the idea that once you enter that system, you get this initial welcome to Medicare visit, and it's basically, the health risk assessment breaks it down in terms of creating important baselines of just exactly where's your health status today, and then how do we track that forward and kind of identify problem areas, things to work on, and actually track it from year to year, to whether you're going up, down, or sideways. So that's pretty brilliant to actually get that incorporated.
Yeah, thank you. It was quite the fun event. And we have another bill up there now that we'll probably have to do on another show that we've been working on with some of your input as well. So maybe we can get to that at some point in a future episode.
Sure. Good deal. Well, we have mentioned that on prior shows, so good to have the context and the background. And, those walk and talks kind of look like you were in a pressure cooker with an elevator pitch on steroids, So congratulations on being good for you being crisp and present for carrying the message. So, okay, well, tried to lay out the context for our conversation today. We just got back from the Florida Association of ACO's fifth annual meeting, and the founder and CEO, Nicole Bradbury, has mentioned this rollout of Value H, which is not just Florida domiciled, but a national association that will appeal to the thought leaders, implementers, doers, you name it, in the value-based healthcare economy, which really is a globally, it's a pretty loose term, what's in the value-based economy per se, from bundled pricing to full risk-bearing Medicare Advantage plans, I think one could pack into that. So where do you want to go in terms of maybe just a scan of top-line news in the accountable care, pop health, value-based economy? What's top of mind for you, Fred?
Yeah, let me first say this, which is kind of interesting because you've mashed this up in a great way, value-based care, population health. And I can tell you, you were at the event, I believe, a few years back at the Population Health Alliance, where we had some great presentations by Kaveh Safavi and David Nash that year. And when they had finished up, I recall now that we had a quick discussion up there. And one of the questions I threw out to them, and this must have been 5 years ago or so, was, should we be working pricing and cost into our population health programs? And the answer at that time was no. But now you're seeing it. When you start talking value and you say, well, we're going to take a population health approach to it, value has to include, what that cost is of that service, and could it be delivered with similar or better quality at a lower or same price?
Right.
And so it's kind of it's fascinating. I think, you know, Nicole's hit upon it with this value age, this idea that you merge this together and suddenly you're looking at all the various components to improve the health of that population, including the cost.
Right.
So,
yeah,
you know,
some would,
go on.
Some would say, sorry to interrupt, some would say, you know, Pop Health is merely public health 2.0 or 3.0, and ACOs and population level initiatives are simply, you know, HMOs of a different strain. So when you have the total cost of care perspective versus the shell game of shifting cost from here to here, it's a different challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, ACOs are beginning to get it. Obviously, you're seeing a push on the market from the CMS saying, well, you know, you may have been delivering better quality and we're seeing your quality go up, but we haven't seen a whole heck of a lot from your cost savings. And so pushing these to two-sided risk in the MSSP-1 programs,
right.
And efforts like that. And I think we're seeing the other one that's been interesting to watch is employers. And a number of people have pointed to the fact that employers are – watch the employers. They're going to be driving it. And that's what I talked about at an AMCP meeting this last week in a training session was watch the employers, whether around pharmacy costs or others. They're going to innovate rapidly. And so we saw some of that in the news.
AMCP is what?
The Academy of Managed Care Pharmacies. You know, so it's all the managed care pharmacies, as well as a lot of the manufacturers themselves come to these training sessions and to that big annual conference they run,
mm-hmm.
which is very well done.
Okay. So this new awareness at the employer level, born out of a certain level of frustration that third-party payers – Aetna's, Cigna's, the Blues, et cetera, United, aren't delivering the goods. So what's new in the direct employer contracting world, whether it be through ACOs or TPAs or direct, what's new, what's happening there that could be seen as innovation?
So, you know, obviously the direct contracting, you know, we talked about earlier the stuff with Amazon where they're thinking about it and beginning to analyze it. Well, now we've got companies actually doing it. So we saw the, you know, GM direct contract with Henry Ford, and we just had the recent news this past week or so with Ochsner through their ACO doing a direct contract with Walmart for the Walmart employees to use Ochsner's accountable care organization as their delivery network. And so I really think this, at least for the larger employers, you've got this opportunity through direct contracting, and we'll see more of that sort of disintermediating the health plan themselves since they're already self-insured and saying, let's just get it over to the provider, take out a layer and see if we can improve the health outcomes for our employees and lower our costs at the same time.
Right. You know, it's interesting to me. Ochsner is a trophy nameplate. It is an integrated delivery system, though I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure they have their own health plan as well. So they have an alignment of interest, if you will, between the delivery system, participating physicians, and the health plan. But it's noted in this article that this is the first time Ochsner has partnered in this capacity with a large national employer. Maybe they've done some local stuff, but this is the first time working with a national organization. Of course, Walmart includes Sam's employees as well.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ochsner's got a big footprint. They've got the state pretty much. And it also, when you think about it, it also helps from a defensive perspective because there are other, you know, ways, whether you look at maybe Aetna's pretty big in that state with their CVS pharmacies, and they start linking that up as a primary care network or something. So to wrap up a fairly large client is a good way to go. And I think it'll be interesting to see how much Walmart does this in other places and to what level they can take it down to a smaller, do they have enough in certain cities where there's not an Ochsner that's throughout the state as an ACO.
Yeah. It's noted in the article that they've partnered with 10 other health systems in other states. So obviously it's not restricted to Ochsner and the Louisiana market. It also interesting that the goals of the program here is to reduce emergency room usage and increase primary care physician visits with the expectation that this will lower the total cost of care from the health plan's perspective.
Yeah, and that's a great thing. And the good thing about that is pretty easy to measure, you know.
Right.
You can quickly determine if you're getting the outcomes. And obviously the key to some of that is access to those primary care networks. You have them open enough.
Right.
Are they late? Weekend hours. Right. You start building that, make it meet the needs of the employees, and you can quickly solve that ER problem.
Well, I wish them good luck. And, of course, we saw this play out in the 80s and 90s. So perhaps revisiting a healthcare sector at almost at 20% of GDP versus whatever it was then, a fraction of it back then, is a renewed emphasis on, okay, really, how do we make this work? We've been at it a while. Let's make it happen.
Yep. Absolutely.
So what's next?
The other one that I just found fascinating this week was the Utah employees, where there are 160,000 state employees in the Utah Public Employee Plan and family members, and they have decided to give them the option to go to Mexico and pick up about 20 high-cost drugs and bring them back. And as part of that, they're going to pay for the trip.
Right.
Make an easier access line to get through the border. They claim the clinic down there is as good as a Mayo or any other place. They've vetted that the drugs are safe and they're what you're getting. And then they'll pay the employee $500 to do that, which is a great way to incent this. We've seen where, you know, Walmart is using a narrow network approach, say, for their back surgeries and sending people to Houston and giving you the option to go there for nothing or get it out, you know, pay a substantial out of pocket locally. But this is taking it even one step further and providing a financial reason for the employee to go do this.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that could take off quickly. And then the question becomes, does pharma say, well, we're going to cut off the supply of our drugs to Mexico or something, which is they've threatened around Canada. So it should be interesting to watch.
I love the article here. You know, it opens with, amid a flurry of national proposals to bring exorbitant U.S. drug prices in line with other countries' charges, one Utah insurer has a different option for patients. Pay them to go to Mexico. Of course, that's near and dear to my heart because living in San Diego, I frequently cross that border and avail myself of deeply discounted pharma pricing. So, yeah, it's interesting. PEHP. Now, is this the Public Employees Union of
I believe that stands for Public Employee Health Plan or something like that.
Okay, yeah. And the $500 cash payout. Now, they must triage this or segment it in such a way where they understand sort of the tail of drug coverage and what might be suitable to reflect in this package pricing, including transportation, because you got to figure out there's a return here to the health plan as well as a quality. Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, you can post up this article on the site and it lists the drugs at the end of it that they're paying for. And so they know these are high cost drugs in the United States. As I told the pharma group this last week, it's coming that, you know, people have finally said, we're going to find a way to solve it or go around
right.
it. And they're going around it here. I think, you know, and it's a huge group. It's 160,000 lives. I think you'll see more of this.
Right.
You know, could other states, as a matter of fact, piggyback on this just because, you know, like I know with certain legislative things, if one city has contracted with somebody, another city can jump onto that contract. I wonder if states are allowed to do something like that. And potentially you'd see more of them just piggyback off of what they've done in Utah.
Yeah, so here's the answer to my earlier question. So in the article, it notes the insurer rolled out its pharmacy tourism option this fall in response to state legislation requiring state employee insurance plans to offer, quote, savings rewards or cash incentives to patients who choose cheaper providers. The plan is offering pharmacy tourism benefits for about a dozen drugs, for which the price disparity between countries is vast. For example, Avonex, which treats MS, costs about $6,700 for a 28-day supply in the U.S., but about $2,200 through PEP's contracted clinic in Tijuana. So there you go. Hard dollars.
Yeah, you know, perhaps you tie in a couple extra days in Mexico with it.
Yeah.
Use your $500 to stay for a couple days and enjoy yourself, have enough time on the beach, et cetera.
Speaking of, you know, the extrapolation of where else can we leverage these kinds of market inefficiencies, think dental. you've got American-trained, board-certified dentists operating in Tijuana who operate at a fraction of the shake-and-bake retail dental operations in the United States, many of whom are under contract to big guerrilla health plans like Kaiser Permanente and simply pass on rack rate pricing to the member through a referral agreement between the plan and the dental operator. So, I mean, I'm just thinking, wow, you know. I have a whole story there. I'll leave it offline for now, but trust me, there's a big, big hiccup there in pricing differentials.
Oh, yeah, the dental stuff's amazing. And imagine, as a health plan, if you're a fully insured product, these kinds of things will just knock your medical expenditures down so much and lower your MLR that you'd have to drop your rates. And you're getting 15% of a smaller number, so you're not going to do it.
Right. Yeah, right. So we're really talking about not just sort of trend minus 1 or 2%. We're talking about flat and declining.
Yeah, which is exactly what, you know.
Imagine that. Yeah.
Warren Buffett said, you know, we're not looking for 1 to 3%. We're looking way bigger than that. Well, here's a simple way to do it right here in front of you. And there are others, like you talk about, dental. You could do, surgeries at Health City Cayman Island and begin to move.
Oh, yeah.
And I think ultimately, just as with the some of the recommendations coming out of the White House around pricing, ultimately it's got to come down, and the individuals that are pricing these products need to bring them down closer to what we're seeing in other places around the world.
Exactly. Yeah, you and I are on the same page there, Fred. So we're kind of winding down the half hour here. So what else is top of mind for you?
I think, you know, that I've seen, you know, some of the stuff now coming out of D.C. that we've talked about. I think the site of care regs, if they can put that in place. The experiment by CMS,
the payer
CMMI.
The payer neutral
site of care.
Yeah.
Right, where if you're getting an infusion in a doctor's office and getting the same drug by the same doctor in an outpatient center or a hospital and they're paying more, that just logically doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And so I think that, along with the new proposal where they're trying to price drugs based on these other countries around the world and as a percent of that or something, and do a test through CMMI to half of the Medicare recipients, is something that will ultimately help push these. I do think also, you know, as I heard at the conference, pharma's interested in value-based care. They're trying to figure out how they can play in that, how they can play a role in supporting that. But at the end of the day, I think the recognition is there's got to be a drop in these prices. And that's what we're starting to see. But as we talked about earlier and offline, a lot of this change is really going to be driven by employers. They've got a lot of flexibility right now, at least the self-insured groups, and are saying, let's see what other ideas we can implement for our employees to help us lower the costs and maintain or improve the quality, thereby creating better value.
Yeah, for sure. I hear you there. So let's just cue in our little closing music here and wind this down because we have to. And that, I want to thank Fred. That'll have to be the last word for today's broadcast. I want to thank my colleague and co-host and co-founder of Pop Health Week, Fred Goldstein, who is the president of Accountable Health LLC, for his time and generous insights today. Do follow Fred and Accountable Health's work on the web by www.accountablehealthllc.com and on Twitter via @FSGoldstein. And finally, if you are tasked with strategy, standing up an ACO or value-based healthcare initiative, or otherwise feel drawn to contribute to the emerging world of value-based healthcare, contact me at Greg@healthinnovationmedia.com or on Twitter via @2HealthGuru. And Fred and I will be happy to entertain your needs and lend our subject matter expertise to your organization or venture. So until we meet again on Pop Health Week, for Fred Goldstein. This is Greg Masters saying bye now.